needed.
Good afternoon, and as promised, the first speaker is Dane County District Attorney Zan. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Ishmael Ozan, Dane County District Attorney. I represent the state of Wisconsin in the law enforcement action in Dane County Circuit Court to enforce open meetings law. The points I wish to make are the current petitions for supervisory writ and leave to appeal should be dismissed or denied. Wisconsin's open meeting law is a valid exercise of the legislative power. It gives meaning and substance to the constitutional mandate of Article 4, Section 10. The open meeting law is presumed to be constitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. And at this time, the arguments of the Attorney General on behalf of Petitioner Hipsch and the state represent an attack on the constitutionality of the open meeting law, both on its face and as applied. The legislature does have the ability to determine what is going to be law. The state has never argued that, and in its wisdom, it codified Article 4, Section 10 of the Constitution.
Are you beginning your argument as to your request for dismiss or deny the supervisory writ, or where are you going? Or is this another point you're making? No, I got to take notes. I got to know where you're going.
I can go straight to dismiss or deny.
No, whatever you want.
That's fine.
It just wasn't clear to me.
I would note that the final judgment in the circuit court has made both petitions moot. And at this time, the petition for supervisory writ does not have an adequate party. The judgment of the circuit court is final. There is an adequate remedy for this issue or issues to be brought to this court, and that is a direct appeal.
Who is aggrieved that has the right to appeal a final action at this particular point in time?
At this point in time, the body's politic could appeal. The body's politic, the Senate, the Assembly, the committee as it stood on March 9th.
You think that they're a proper party to sue and to be sued, so they have to fall into there if they're going to be able to appeal?
We named them in order to have jurisdiction for the court. We also named all of the members of the committee as it stood on March 9th, which would be leadership in both houses.
I understand that, but my question is more narrow. I want to know who is it that is aggrieved that to that person this is a final judgment and they can appeal.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say the Secretary of State is aggrieved, but I think he has issues as to whether or not he would like to appeal.
If he's not aggrieved, then he can't get through the first step of the statute, right?
If a party wishes to join the lower court, they could.
I'm just looking at the lower court judgment, and if you tell me the body politics can appeal, because certainly they would be aggrieved, then you have to also be telling me that they are a proper party to sue and be sued. Can you tell me that?
I believe as, and this is obviously where the experience of the appellate court and this court's jurisdiction are somewhat lacking on our office. It deals mostly with criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that experience lies elsewhere in the state. But we believe that they were proper parties to join. As the open meetings law stated that they were subject to the open meetings law requirements. I believe that either the Senate or the Assembly could ask the Attorney General to proceed on its behalf or in the interest of the state.
Well, the state would have to intervene because they're not a party in the lower court action at this point.
That is true, but I believe that they could be asked to intervene and then would be a proper party.
Okay, but the state is not. I'm just looking at the folks that are parties, and I think the only ones you've identified for me that you think are both aggrieved and to whom this is a final judgment are really the Assembly and the Senate, correct?
The other parties could appeal. They may not be aggrieved in that manner, but they have interests that are justiciable.
Well, they may not be adversarial.
What other parties are you
adversarial?
Talking? What other parties?
Senator Miller, Representative Barca, I believe they would both have interest in the issues present before this court.
But they're not aggrieved. They got what they wanted.
Arguably, right? Potentially, that may be true, but that doesn't necessarily mean they don't have interest. They would want to appeal and have this court hear.
They still have to be aggrieved, and that's what I wanted you to focus on. So the only people I hear you telling me that are both aggrieved and to whom you think it's a final judgment are the Senate and the Assembly, and then I guess it's for us to figure out whether they're a proper party to sue or be sued in order to determine whether a party aggrieved has a final judgment they can appeal, right?
There could be parties that are aggrieved that could join. They have not yet. There are four named defendants who have
well, not... Well, it's not a final judgment as to them. She specifically withheld judgment on what she was going to do about the forfeitures for the named individual legislators. So I can't see how it's a final judgment as to them.
As it relates to the declaratory judgment, the voiding of the action of the committee, I believe it would be a final judgment and is stated as such. As to the forfeitures, they did not have jurisdiction due to their privilege,
sure.
And those are in abeyance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, are we talking about a 30-day period of time within which there'd have to be a notice of appeal filed?
I believe that the standards would require that.
So there's no question right now of sufficient time to appeal?
No, I believe there's sufficient time, and I believe that appeal could be expedited if needed.
Why do you think that appealing is more appropriate than this court taking original jurisdiction?
I believe there are still questions at issue. This court has raised some as to publication, as to other facts that some are of record in the lower court and have not made it into what's before you today.
And you're satisfied that our case law generally says if there are genuine issues of material fact, it's not appropriate for original jurisdiction. Is that right?
I believe that's what you've held in the past.
What is your position on publication?
I do not believe publication was accomplished.
So that this was never became law?
At this point, I don't believe it has.
And could you describe the authority that you think that you have under 1997 sub 2?
The authority that the legislature vested in the district attorney was that upon receiving a verified complaint, that we could bring an action regarding the open meetings law violation.
When does your injunction authority kick in?
I believe when the legislature put in its policy declaration that this should be liberally construed and then specifically said that the remedies could be injunction, declaratory judgment, or voiding. I believe that then equity would rely that those remedies be used in accordance with getting satisfaction for those aggrieved.
Well, Justice Gableman was asking some questions this morning about when this injunction authority commenced. Let's say a legislator introduces a bill and there isn't adequate notice for a public hearing on that bill, but it's passed out of the committee and goes to the floor. Could you get an injunction blocking the state Senate from taking up that bill?
Those aren't the facts that are before you today.
Yeah, but I'm asking you. It's a violation of the open meeting law. We've established that.
What you would have to find out is whether or not there was a meaningful opportunity to cure the violation. And at that point in the process, I don't know the exact facts or the situation.
What
if
is that?
The meeting, if the violation was cured, then there would be no reason for an injunction, no reason for an action to be brought.
What do you mean cure the violation?
Renoticing of the hearing, or retaking a vote, holding, giving proper notice, giving proper access.
Well, was the fact that both houses passed this bill here, did that cure any violation?
No, it did not. In this fact scenario before you, the Joint Committee of Conference was brought because both houses could not act on the legislation. The action of the committee was the essence of what allowed both houses to move forward. So if that action is a nullity, the actions that the houses then create on that action is also a nullity. In this fact scenario before you, the violation occurred at the Joint Committee of Conference. That then moved immediately to the Senate, who had the opportunity to cure, who had notice of the alleged violation, who were present during the alleged violation and participated in it. Then it moved to the Assembly. At the same time, their leadership had actual notice and participated as well. They voted and moved it forward. It goes to the governor, who I believe probably had actual notice as well that there was an alleged violation, and he signed it. At those three points, there was an opportunity to cure. The Senate could have sent it back to the committee, the Assembly could have sent it back to the committee, or the governor could have vetoed and sent it back to the Assembly or the legislature to cure that defect. At that point, they could have moved forward and there would have been no ability. It would have been cured. I guess we could have still had a violation, but we would only be talking about forfeitures on whether or not it was knowing and voluntary, and I don't believe you would have had that scenario. That's not what happened here. We moved for the court to intervene at the last point in which there was an option to cure had already been passed. And I believe the statute was clear when it said that there is injunctive relief, there is declaratory judgments, and there is voiding of the actual act for that to happen. The problem you have here was there was no ability to cure without going back to the committee.
Counselor, in regard to the notice requirements, what notice do you believe was required?
I believe at this time there was a 24-hour notice required.
Okay. Can you please explain for me why you don't think Section 19.84, subsection 6, does not apply? And I want you to do that in light of findings of fact number 15, which is apparently what the Senate was relying on, Senate Rule 93, sub 2. So why don't those two fit together and then we don't have to worry about the 24-hour notice?
Fact 19?
Yeah, it's finding of 15. Finding of fact 15 says that the Senate chief clerk relied on Senate Rule 93 sub 2, which provides that no notice is required for this type of a meeting. And I'm wanting to know why I shouldn't look at subsection 6 and say, hey, the Senate was relying on their own rule. It seems like they get to put their own rules in place under the open meetings law. Why shouldn't I rely on that for whether or not there was a violation of the timing or the notice?
The Senate has the ability to govern itself. Their rules do not govern the Assembly. The same for the Assembly. Their rules govern the Assembly but do not govern the Senate.
Right.
They created the joint rules to govern when they both meet. In that case, why you look to the joint rules.
Well, they weren't both meeting, though, at this particular time. There was a committee, the Committee on Conference, the Joint Committee on Conference.
The Committee on Conference is specifically created within the joint rules, and therefore the joint rules would apply. Both houses are together. The Senate rules would not rule over the Assembly members who are present at that meeting, nor would the Assembly rules rule over the Senate. And that joint body, you will, is not purely an Assembly or a Senate body. it is something entirely different in and of itself.
You are aware that the Assembly has exactly the same rule, word for word, as Senate Rule 93-2. The Assembly has Assembly Rule 93-2.
And as well, they could have made Joint Rule 93 that could have covered the Joint Committee, or they could have added to Joint Rule 3.
And they could have, but she made a finding of fact that that's the rule they relied on. And underneath Stitt, why do we look further? If that's the rule they relied on, why should we be looking at something else? There clearly is a rule under the statutes that says you don't have to give notice if you've got a body rule. And the finding of fact says, hey, that's what they relied on. Now, you can say they relied wrongly on that rule, but that's questioning their own application of their own rules. And I guess my concern really focuses on Stitt. And if we're going to say, hey, if they relied on their own rules, that's the end of the story, unless there's a constitutional violation.
I think you would look to 19.87, legislative meetings, and then go to sub 2, no provision of the subchapter which conflicts with a rule of the Senate or Assembly or joint rule of the legislature shall apply to a meeting conducted in compliance with such rule. And I think that the reference to joint rule specifically references this situation where the committee should have looked to the
joint rule. What you're saying to me is they applied the wrong rule. They should have applied a joint rule. What I'm saying to you is look at Stitt, where we say if the legislature relies on one of their own rules, we don't interpret whether they did their own rule right or not, unless there's constitutional violation, correct?
And here you have that in violation of the open meetings law, in which the legislature took it upon themselves to codify Article 4.
Well, I have to buy that argument in order to get there. I mean, I tend to think you got to, frankly, amend the Constitution by the provisions in a different section of the Constitution, but I understand that argument. So, but do you agree with me that if, in fact, they relied on their own rule, and she made a finding on it that that's what they did, if they applied the wrong rule, unless there's a constitutional violation, we don't look at whether they applied their rule correctly or followed their rule correctly, right?
But I think you need to look at the whole statute to figure out whether or not they meant for this to apply to them, what their plain meaning of the statute was, which was a codification of Article 4, Section 10.
Well, you know, I understand that argument, okay? So then you got to find it's a constitutional violation every time you violate the statute. That's a pretty broad holding you're asking this court to make. We generally don't say when you violate a statute, you violate the Constitution. But I understand the argument. But I was just trying to put this in the context of Stitt and in the context of her findings of fact, which says what they relied on.
I think Stitt would not go against our argument, which would be that if there's constitutional mandate, that
right,
the court does have an ability to come in.
So you think Stitt applies because you have the second step here. But if there wasn't a constitutional violation, then under Stitt, you wouldn't do anything further except, well, she said that's what they relied on, that's it.
I think where you are looking at does a difference in this in the open meetings law violate the Constitution. The legislature has the ability to change its mind about the open meetings law.
Sure.
It wrote it. It's perceived to be constitutional and given deference. In the open meetings law, it is clear that it is to apply to the legislature, the Senate, the Assembly, and the joint committees.
Sure. I'm not struggling with you about that. I was just,
Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
And just the matter of if they use the wrong section within the open meetings law, that does not stop it from becoming a violation. And by a violation, I mean a constitutional violation.
What is the constitutional violation? The notice violation is statutory. The only constitutional violation that I heard about this morning was a locked door kind of situation. Right.
An access issue, but well, to give meaningful and meaning and substance to access, you need notice. The doors of the house could be open, but if no one can show up or knows when to show up, it's meaningless.
Well, people attended this meeting, so all right. So you're trying to say the notice provision is not statutory, it's constitutional, as well as what you call the access problem.
I believe the notice gives the structure and the substance to what the legislature meant in codifying the access issue,
I see.
Giving it meaning.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's a fair answer.
Counsel, may I just...
He dipped in Milwaukee Journal to say that the statute has to be equal to the Constitution?
No, I don't read it as being the statute is equal to, but it pulls in the Constitution and basically...
is a nexus.
Codifies the Constitution.
Do you agree that there's...
Yes.
There has to be a nexus. Under finding 15, I don't know it's been properly stated here. The finding is not that the legislature relied on Senate Rule 93-2. It's that the chief clerk relied on that.
Well, the chief clerk was ordered by the legislature. I'm sorry if I short-circuited it. I thought we were kind of communicating, but you're right. That's exactly what it says.
Oh, we have to be a little careful about that. You're on a motion to dismiss. I mean, that's what you want to happen. If that would be granted on no, the petition for leave to appeal is gone, the writ for supervisory review is gone, the only thing left is a judgment by the trial court, whether it's final or not final. It is appealable by leave or otherwise. And the question the court asked is, who can appeal it? And the answer is different. The state says nobody. On the other hand, the state asserts that it has an interest and that it is, in effect, a party by statute. On the other hand, it doesn't want to say it will appeal, either in its own right under state or on behalf of Mr. Hipsch. You say Secretary La Follette can appeal, and it was justiciable in that there was a controversy and the state came in and represented Mr. La Follette. Mr. La Follette says he still might appeal. He hasn't decided. So, obviously, there are people who don't want that judgment to stand, right? Not you. You would like it to stand. But seems as if the court ought to give, or there ought to be a remedy somewhere to get at this judgment, right?
Correct.
Of course, it's important. It's interesting. It affects the state statute, et cetera. How do you think we should get at it?
I believe that should come to you through direct appeal.
Direct appeal? By whom? The state? You don't care.
The government could join. The governor could join. The secretary, the AG could join. The four legislators could change their mind, and they could join.
No one's argued, partially because it's not quite here, but it is because the legislators may have immunity is the wrong word. The Constitution provides a privilege. Legislature may have a privilege as to forfeiture, but may not have a privilege as to a declaratory action. In fact, there's some language in some of the cases that deal with immunity, but on that. Is that what you're proposing?
That could be. We weren't going to make that determination, but that would go in line with Lister. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lister was the case I was referring to. The problem I have two problems. One, to say that supervisory writ is gone, well, the order is gone. It's now been replaced. What are the findings of fact in the temporary order that the circuit court rendered?
The findings of fact for the injunction?
Yeah.
I believe they found that we had a likelihood of success, that there was a potential for irreparable harm.
It was the four criteria for issuing a TRO, right? But no other finding of facts are there at all. Nothing about when notice was given nothing on the TRO. The petition has some facts asserted by the Attorney General, right?
Correct.
And I don't know if they've been placed into dispute or not. In fact, the Attorney General says the only facts that to be considered on that supervisory writ are the facts the Attorney General set forth in the petition and in its reply. So why are we talking about the final findings of fact when only before us is that TRO?
I believe we were requested to talk about the merits or be prepared.
Okay. All right. But you have to go to the final to get there is the question I'm asking you. All right. Then the leave to appeal is also questionable because that TRO is gone. We have the same problems. Is that why you want it dismissed?
Yes, I believe it. It wouldn't solve the issues before this court. It would be advisory. You have a final judgment. This could be a direct appeal. You could have a full record before you with all the exhibits, with all the testimony.
Transcript been made up yet?
Yes, the transcript has been made.
Transcript of the proceedings before the circuit court judge are all typed up, ready to go if there was an appeal?
I believe they are.
Okay.
Counsel, I'm looking at the amended complaint, which you as district attorney caused to be filed in the circuit court for Dane County. And I see that, among other things, the relief you are seeking is a judgment declaring that the actions taken by the Joint Committee of Conference, consisting of defendants Senator Scott Fitzgerald, Senator Michael Ellis, Senator Mark Miller, Representative Jeff Fitzgerald, Representative Scott Souter, and Representative Peter Barca have violated the provisions of the open meetings law. Is that true?
That's correct.
But yet when I look down to paragraph 5, I see you seek forfeitures to everyone except Senator Miller and Representative Barca. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Why?
There had to be actions that were knowingly done in violation of the open meetings law.
Right,
at this
because
time, the facts show that Barca did not vote or his vote was not recorded. Senator Miller was not present.
Why are they defendants?
They were named when we brought the body politic in. We named everyone who was a member of that committee. They are also members of leadership in both houses.
But you've just told me that they didn't do anything wrong.
They may have a defense to the violation, but they are not facing forfeitures either.
Did they do something wrong or not?
I believe they have a defense to the violation of the open meetings law. I don't believe that Senator Miller could have voted and done anything to violate the open meetings law because he was not present. So he does have an affirmative defense. Representative Barca, I don't believe, voted. So I think he has also an affirmative defense, and as you know, he is the one that sent us, or one of the people who sent us, a verified complaint of the incident.
So I renew my question. Why are they defendants?
We named them when we named the body politic. We served the Senate, the Assembly, and all its leadership, as well as the clerks.
And they are
part of the body.
Sure,
they were
are,
part of the body that had the violation for the open meetings law.
Sure they are, but that doesn't really address my question, does it? You could have brought suit against anybody, but as a district attorney, you have a responsibility not to bring legal action against people who didn't do anything wrong. And you could have brought suit against anybody, but that's not a reason for doing it, is it?
Yeah, there is. As you would say, just because I can doesn't mean I should. Now, in this instance, the committee as a whole was named. The committee's actions as a whole were in violation of the open meetings law.
I know who was named, counsel. I have your amended complaint in front of me. But you're not answering my question, and maybe that's because you can't. But since you filed the complaint, I assume you as district attorney who made the charging decision would know why they were defendants.
They are defendants because they are part of the committee that violated the open meetings law.
Even though you're saying they didn't do anything wrong?
They may have a defense to that violation. They are not facing forfeitures. And for us to get at the violation, we named the committee, the Senate, the Assembly, and all its members.
So for you to get at the violation, does that mean for you to gather information about the violation?
No, it was for us to bring a party in front of the court. We had the Secretary of State, who we had also filed against, but he did not commit a violation of the open meetings law as well.
In the earlier part of our little colloquy here, you've already indicated that Senator Miller would not be liable. True?
I believe he has a defense. He was not present. I do not see how, in the end, if we are going at just Senator Miller, how he would be liable. The committee, though, as a body, had a violation, had the violation.
I wonder if I'm translating you correctly, and maybe I'm not, counsel. Sounds to me like you think that they were sort of either necessary or indispensable parties because they were part of the group, sort of like why the AG in their petition for supervisory writ named people they defended, that they represent. They named the Fitzgeralds, they named State Assembly, the State Senate, because in a petition for supervisory writ, you're supposed to name everybody that were in the lower court. So,
you mean they? Well, go ahead and respond. Say yes.
Some people ask and answer the questions, I guess.
Right, there you go. There you go.
As I said, yes, we would have been trying to bring a party before the court.
And that's what I hear when you keep saying body politic, that you named the joint committee, and then you put in all of the people on it, as did Mr. Hibsch and the state of Wisconsin. But you're not holding them liable because of knowledge. This is a scienter offense.
Yes, they are not facing the forfeiture action.
That's not a criminal offense.
No, but it is a law enforcement action, I guess. It talks about a penal aspect only being allowed forfeitures.
Yeah, there's been some language in the cases that this is sort of quasi-penal.
Yes.
That's all right. I was only going to dispute the premise of the Chief Justice's question, and it's not necessary.
Thank you.
Can I just get you off that for a minute and ask you a couple of basic questions? What are you saying they did wrong? They didn't give 24 hours notice? They didn't give 2 hours notice? Or give me the hour part of it.
There was no 24-hour notice.
Okay.
Required, and it was required.
Okay. And then is there anything else that you're saying that they did wrong? Because this morning there was some discussion of locked doors and... You know, I'm looking through the file. I'm trying to figure out when and to whom were the doors of the joint conference locked.
My understanding of the facts as they came in were that the joint committee of conference was held in the Senate parlor, that room was set up as such that they determined only 20 people could actually...
Because more media was in there.
Random members from the public could be present. We had people who testified that... They attempted access and were denied and left.
Is it because it was locked or because it was full? That's where I'm getting kind of stuck. Because I heard Justice Bradley say, you know, locked. How can locked be open? Is it that it was full or that it was locked? Because there's a difference, don't you think?
There was testimony that the doors of the gallery to the Senate were locked. And people were actually locked
to the place where they were having this meeting, or to the Senate gallery, which is not the place where
there is testimony that there was locked doors of the Senate gallery.
But that's not where they had the meeting. That'd be like showing up here to watch the meeting. That's not going to do you a lot of good either, right? So help me out. Where they were having the meeting, were the doors locked?
I'm trying to get there.
Okay.
There is testimony, I believe, that the gallery of the Senate was locked. And there were people actually locked within there. There is testimony
Let's back up, because this gets confusing. Maybe I don't understand the structure. I thought the parlor is that back rectangular room. Right? Am I right? Help me out. Seriously, I'm looking
trying,
for
I'm
somebody.
Trying to get there. I'm trying to get there.
Okay. Is the parlor where they had the joint committee conference? Yes. Isn't it that back?
That's my understanding.
Where they often have press conferences and things like that.
That is my understanding.
Okay. And then you have the Senate floor, right? And then you have the gallery, which is above the Senate floor. But that's a separate room. I mean, from the gallery, you can't see what's going on in the parlor, I don't think, right?
That is my understanding.
Okay. So where they were having the joint committee conference, that was that back rectangular room, right? So what difference does it make if the gallery is locked? I'm not getting, there's a disconnect.
I'm not on that point. I'm trying to get to your question, which is how was access in the parlor? Now, it's my understanding, as the facts came in, that the Senate gallery was locked and there were people locked in or locked out. That is some of the testimony. It is my understanding as well that they had 20 people that they allowed into the Senate parlor. There was media. I do not know if that is adequate access. The court found that it wasn't. Now, whether or not those doors were locked, I do not know if the actual door to the parlor when you walk through the Senate was locked literally.
Thank
I do
that,
know
I
that the testimony,
it,
that, the testimony that was given was that at 4 o'clock, and I'm sorry to go into these facts, but it seems that this is getting to your question, is that a door in this building, one of two exits that were open, was closed. It was closed because law enforcement was needed to bring to the floor of the Senate to secure the Senate. I do not know if they literally turned the key in the front of the Senate doors. I do know that a greater law enforcement presence was taken to the front of the Senate to keep people out.
Okay.
They allowed 20
but
people. They allowed 20 people in. They allowed set up for media and more than adequate media, I believe, but that is not a substitution for public access.
Okay. Let me clarify for me. Do you have any reason to believe the doors to the Senate parlor were locked? The place where they had the actual, whether you think it's small or whether you think they didn't have enough chairs or whatever that might be, that's different. But were those doors locked so that people couldn't get in and out? Because that's the inference that at least I gathered from some of the questioning this morning.
I guess I did not
You charged it.
I did not ask a specific question, and I do not know, to tell you the truth, the locking mechanism of those back doors to the parlor. But the access to the parlor, which you have to go through the Senate chamber to get to, I believe there was law enforcement in front of that, not allowing people to go through.
After it was full or before it was full?
I do not, well, if you want my specific knowledge, I've been in the parlor when they've had
probably close to 100
people in.
What did you charge? What was your charging decision? What's the allegation in your charging document?
The allegation is that there was a violation of the open meetings law.
Specifically,
there was a lack of notice. There wasn't any notice. The court found that there was a lack of access as well.
Okay, but I'm just asking what that is, because to me this morning it sounded like people were physically, doors were blocked. You cannot enter. No public access. It wasn't that it was full. It was that they were locked out. And that's why I'm trying to figure out. You're the DA. You're the guy. So
my understanding is that they, whoever it may be, decided they would allow 20 random people in. I don't know. It's hard to tell because I was not present.
Me either.
And there is the video from the media there. You cannot tell whether the full room was open or not. We do know that there was testimony that that was not considered one of the larger meeting rooms for purposes of meetings that have this great of public interest.
Okay, I just wondered what you were charging, because I got a little lost in some of the questioning when people said doors were locked. How can that be open when they're locked? And I wondered if that's really what you charged, because I didn't really see that you were charging that they locked people out, let public in.
Is that a question as to whether or not we read it as the door must be locked?
Well, that's what was said this morning.
In order to deny access?
That's a legal question. All I'm saying is I'm asking you, did you charge that they actually locked the doors and wouldn't let the people in? Or is it more of a broader concept of there wasn't enough access, there wasn't enough you know, it's to me, it's they're two different things. If they're actually physically locked versus a broader, not enough people were allowed in.
I think the access question is a reasonableness, and I believe the court, the lower court, heard the testimony and made a finding on that and said, I believe it wasn't reasonable. There was a violation of access.
Yeah, I'm not
the clear violation, from my standpoint, was a violation of the 24-hour notice. There was none. And I don't believe that's in dispute.
Okay, thank you.
You charged in the amended complaint, I'm looking at 19. The open meeting laws apply to members. The codification of mandates provided in the Constitution of Article 1, Section 4, which we haven't heard about before today. I mean, I've heard about it before. Okay. The right of the people to peacefully assemble, consult for the common good, petition the government shall never be abridged. And then you want to say, and that the doors of each house shall be kept open. That's 410, which we did look at, and you referred to 19.81.3. So you charged notice, and you charged that it violated the Constitution, under 19. Am I reading your complaint wrong, counsel?
No, you are not. That is correct.
All right. I've only gotten up to 19. Is there any other place that you say that there's another one, 37, that talks about public access to the joint committee. There you cite 19.87.
And I guess I did not read access as literally meaning the door itself was locked, but that you were denied access.
Well, I think what the circuit court found, just to short circuit all this, is that there was an officer there, and when there were 20 people in, the officer said, we're not letting anybody else in. That was the finding. I don't think that there is anything that I have seen. I've just been rereading the findings.
And I'm not sure if that was the sergeant of arms or
an actual officer. Yeah, it says an officer, so it could have been that, too, but it says an officer. Here, so.
Counsel. That leads me to a basic question. We keep talking about findings of fact. The only findings of fact I can find in the record that are made by a disinterested, neutral, impartial decision maker are in the May 26th findings, right? We keep coming to that. We don't go back to the petition for supervisory writ for findings. Well, that's why you say motion to dismiss. I'm trying to get you back to your point and then say, is there anything else you want to say now that the red light is on?
Thank you. I believe you are correct. There are... The court did ask whether those questions of findings of fact or issues in dispute, and we attempted to try and communicate to all the parties to figure out if there were any other issues. Obviously, each in their own way answered that question, and there were facts that could be in dispute. I think it is clear that the legislature, if you looked to Goodlin, and Justice Gableman did cite to Goodlin earlier, and I think at Section 6, it's clear that the legislature, it makes its own rules, prescribes its own procedure, subject only to provisions of the Constitution, and it is its province to determine what shall be enacted into law. And I believe it has done that, just that, in the open meetings law. And I think that it was very clear in the open meetings law that it was citing to Article 4, Section 10, and subjecting or allowing the Attorney General, the District Attorney, or a member of the public to bring an action for a violation of this portion or this right within the Constitution. I believe it was also the legislature who put forward in the very beginning of the open meetings law, where it talks about its declaration of policy, almost eerily similar to that declaration of policy in the public records law, which is noted by this court as one of the strongest declarations of policy in the Wisconsin statutes. I believe here the legislature went even further with its declaration, not only declaring that it was going to be subject to, but by tying that to the Constitution.
Let me ask you a question that I find somewhat intriguing. There's an argument in the brief of the state to the effect that recognizing the decision of this court in City of Oak Creek, that they recognize that the powers of the Attorney General are limited to those given to it by the legislature. And they take that one step further and say, if that's true for the Attorney General, it's true also for the district attorney. How do you respond to that argument?
I would say that I have done nothing other than what the legislature has said in statute I am able to do. The circuit court has done nothing other than what the legislature has asked it to do.
So your response would be that you have legislative authority to take the actions you've been taking?
I believe they prescribed that in the open meetings law. I believe it was clear upon receiving a verified complaint. I do not have the authority of, say, the Attorney General to look into matters or violations on my own. I must receive a verified complaint, and then upon that, I would have jurisdiction to look into that matter and that matter alone.
All right, thank you.
Could I ask
Justice Prosser
a couple of clarifying questions? Did I understand you to say that rules governing a joint committee on conference have to be joint rules?
I believe the joint rules govern the joint committee of conference and govern those times when the bodies come together.
Well, now, for example, if they're talking about a special session of the legislature, a Senate rule governing special sessions of the legislature is not going to be broad enough to cover a joint meeting? Is that your position?
I believe so. The Senate rule would govern the senators in a Senate function. Once the two bodies come together, that is a joint situation, and neither house's rule should govern the other house, the other house's members. Thus, the need for joint rules.
But if you have a Senate rule and an assembly rule that really are virtually the same, and they govern committee meetings in a joint, in a special session, that isn't good enough?
I do not believe it's good enough to get around the open meetings law. The open meetings law was clear, and it references joint rules. It references the committees, and I think that's where you look to see who governs what created the committee of conference. The joint rules created the committee of conference. The joint rules govern that body.
Let me ask one other thing. And this, I think, is following up Justice Ziegler's question. You filed a complaint that talked about inadequate notice, and that's the 24-hour notice, and the circuit court found a violation of the open meetings law in paragraph 80 of the opinion. And then the paragraph 81 talks about a violation of the open meetings law occurred when the Joint Committee on Conference met on March 9th and failed to provide reasonable public access to the meeting. It's my understanding that you didn't charge that. Is that right?
We charged a violation of the open meetings law, which dealt with access and dealt with notice. It's very clear that there was notice. It was clear that there was not sufficient access as well to the Joint Committee of Conference. But that is a reasonableness determination made by the court. because you couldn't say that there was no access. Because we knew that there were members of the public.
Suppose there had been a 24-hour notice, but the meeting had been held in the Senate parlor under exactly the same conditions. Would you have been charging a violation?
Are you asking if the meeting, the joint committee meeting, was held in the Senate parlor?
Yeah.
Could there be an access issue as well?
Yeah.
There would still be a 24-hour notice issue. There could be an access issue.
And no,
I guess in line of Justice Ziegler's questioning, there was testimony that the actual door, the actual lock on the door was locked. There was no admittance and no exit from the parlor or from the gallery of the Senate. That was the testimony that was given.
But the gallery and the place where they had the meeting were two different spots.
The question asked was if the meeting had been held in the chamber of the Senate, which would have then brought the parlor, or I'm sorry, the gallery into whether or not there was access.
Understanding
of the question.
I didn't understand.
What I'm really trying to get at is, as I read Circuit Court's decision, there are two distinct violations of the open meetings law. Is that your understanding?
There are.
Okay. And you clearly charge one of them. That's the time notice. It's not clear to me that you clearly charge the other one.
I don't believe we needed to charge more than one violation to have the remedy that we sought.
Okay.
Or that there were not another violation. I believe we charged a violation of the open meetings law in and of itself. That is, in a sense, access and notice. Notice and access. Notice gives meaning to access.
Well, when was it that the defendants knew that there was a second violation being charged?
When did the defendants know that there was an issue with access? I would say that we informed them of everything that we knew prior to actually issuing the charge. And then we ended up serving each and every one of them at a later date.
Did people violate the open meetings law more than once?
Their actions could be a violation in more than one aspect of the statute. I believe that is clear.
I'd like to follow up on what went on quite some time ago, and that is reference to the Stitt case. And in the Stitt case, the court indicated that its rationale, citing Marbury versus Madison, and it says, the rationale is that failure to follow procedural rules amounts to an implied ad hoc repeal of such rules. Now, as I see the open records law, you have the notice requirement in 19.84, and sub 3 speaks of the 24-hour prior notice In no case may the notice be provided less than 2 hours in advance of the meeting. So that's the law. I think that the Attorney General concedes that generally, at least, I'm reading from the compliance guide put out by the Attorney General. Generally speaking, the open meeting law applies to the state legislature, including the Senate Assembly and any committee or subunits of those bodies. So I think that it concedes that. My question goes to this, with that as a preference. Here we have the violation committed by a committee, not the Senate, not the Assembly. And does a conference committee have the authority to, in the words of Stitt, to ad hoc repeal a statute?
I don't believe you can ad hoc repeal the Constitution or a constitutional mandate, and I believe that is what you have in the open meetings law. That's why it still would be fine with STIT. In STIT, they were saying there was no constitutional mandate in the statute, so therefore there could be an ad hoc repeal. I believe the statute is clear that there are two ways in which or in which the Assembly or the Senate or the legislature as a whole could get around the open meetings law, and that would be to amend the statute and create another exception for themselves, create a rule within their bodies or within the joint committee rules, which would exempt themselves from, well, not necessarily exempt, which would be in contrast to or conflict with the statute. And as long as they operated under that rule, there would not be a violation of the open meetings law. But I believe it's an affirmative action they have to take. It cannot be ad hoc.
Is there any difference, or should there be any difference in our analysis, that it was a committee that did the violation, using Stitt's terms, an ad hoc repeal of a statute or rule, rather than the body itself? Does that difference enter into the analysis?
I think in this case, what you have when you have the Joint Committee of Conference, you have an action that is essential to the
full body acting.
To the full body acting. There was no, and it's clear from the statements from Senator Fitzgerald to the Senate prior, that there was no way for this legislation or for them to move any further. Thus, it made it essential for the Joint Committee to do what it did, to act on the legislation, to put it in a form that the Senate could then move on. The fact that there was a violation, and I think when you look at the rules of the Committee of Conference, states that whatever comes out of there cannot be amended. It's voted on at the one body, sent to the next body, and that's it. If there's any amendment, it comes back to the committee. Had it come back to the committee and there had been proper notice, there may have still been a violation, but it would have been cured and the legislation would have been able to move forward.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a follow-up question in regard to an answer you gave earlier. When you said that the 24 hours notice was required, because I believe you said there was no joint rule in place. Does that sum it up?
There was no joint rule that was in conflict with the open meetings law. So the open meetings law would govern.
Thank you. I'm looking, though, at section 1987 of the open meetings law, the part where it says at the beginning, the open meetings law shall apply to all meetings of the Senate and Assembly and the committees, subcommittees, and other subunits thereof, except that. And then we go down to subsection 2, and we see that no provision of this subchapter which conflicts with the rule of the Senate or Assembly or joint rule of the legislature shall apply to a meeting conducted in compliance with such rule. And then, of course, you probably know where I'm going, Assembly Rule and Senate Rule 93 each required that during a special session, subsection 3 of each of those parallel rules, a notice of hearings before committees is not required other than posting on the legislative bulletin boards, and a schedule of committee activities need not be published. Now, Judge Sumi, in her brief, states that a notice was published or was put on the bulletin boards, I think she used the phrase, a few minutes after 4. So there doesn't seem to be any doubt that notice was put on the bulletin boards. I wonder what the basis is for you to say that because there was no joint rule in place, that parallel provisions of the Senate and the Assembly rules, in the light of Section 1987, subsection 2, would not be adequate notice.
They are not adequate because the Senate rule does not govern the Assembly, and the Senate rule or the Assembly rule does not govern the Senate.
Well, the committee we're talking about, counsel, is composed of members of the Assembly and members of the Senate, right? Yes?
It's clear in
Is that true, counsel?
Yes, you are correct.
And so if each House, if the Assembly has a rule that says that the only notice that's required is posting on the bulletin board, and the Senate has a rule that says the only notice that's required is posting on the bulletin board, I wonder why it is you say that because there's no joint rule, in other words, a rule of the Senate and the Assembly that says the only notice that's required is posting on the bulletin board, that the parallel, the mirror image rules of each House, which was present during this conference, does not apply.
Because I read the statute as referencing or joint rule, meaning the joint rules apply to the joint committee of conference.
Doesn't that reading omit part of the subsection with a rule of the Senate or Assembly or joint rule?
I believe the or joint rule references the joint rules, which govern the committees and which govern the committee of conference, which created the committee of conference. I don't believe you can have a situation, even though at this point you have Senate rules and Assembly rules that seem to mirror on the outside that govern those bodies, that one House could say to the other House, our rules govern. You would have an argument, or you could have one House saying, well, our rules govern, and since you're not here on time, that means we get to go forward. And you could push things through. So sure. I think they need to come together and agree on what's going to govern the two.
I think, as you pointed out earlier in response to a question more at the beginning of your presentation, that's not the case here, is it? Here, they are the same rules. And your interpretation, it seems to me, we may or may not even need to get this, depending on how the constitutional question falls. But since you brought it up, I thought it only fair to give you the opportunity to explain your position. But really, it seems to me, you'd have to read some language into that subsection in order to get the result or the interpretation you're advocating. That, in other words, parallel provisions of the Assembly and the Senate, when both of those branches, when both of those houses of the legislature are meeting, even if they are the same rule, do not apply.
There was testimony from Senate Clerk Rob Marchant that, no, the Senate rules do not govern the Assembly, nor do the Assembly rules govern the Senate, and that the joint rules.
Right, but the only finding of fact we have from Judge Sumi in that regard is that there was no joint rule that conflicted. She said nothing, unless I missed it, and I'm happy to stand to be corrected, unless I missed it in her finding of fact, she said nothing about the rules of the Assembly or the Senate.
I'm at a slight disagree.
Is that accurate?
What we ended up talking about and what was clear, at least through the testimony, is that the joint rules applied. The joint rules did not conflict with the open meetings law, and they could be read together.
So it is accurate to say there's nothing in Judge Sumi's decision in regard to the rules of the Assembly or the rules of the Senate.
I would have to get back to you later this afternoon if I could have time to look through those.
Let me ask you a question, because I hadn't thought about this before you were talking about it, and so now I'm looking at it a little differently or closely. I'm just trying to figure it out. Rule 93 is the Assembly rule, and that's the one that says notice may not be necessary. And same for the Senate, but you're saying neither of those are something we should look at here because they're exclusive to those two legislative bodies, right? And then you say we got to go to the joint rules. And then when I started, I wondered what the joint rules said. So I look at Joint Rule 21, and it talks about the proposals be considered at time and place of the hearings, who presides at the hearings, and any other matters convenient to the hearings may be agreed upon by the chairpersons. So it almost makes it sound like they can set their own timing, according to Rule 21. Then when you look at Rule 27, joint rule, says unless otherwise provided by law, every committee hearing, executive session, other meetings shall be open to the public. If time permits, advance notice of every regularly scheduled hearing, executive session, or other meeting shall be published in accordance with Rule 75, which is the rule that talks about their schedule and how they try to put that out by Monday.
I believe that gets to posting on the website, and that is, again, something above and beyond what would be required, and it's sort of, I don't think you can read that in light of, we'll give notice if time permits. I think that's we will post it on the web if time permits, and that's to be posted daily.
Thank you.
Well, what about Joint Rule 3 of the Committee of Conference of Joint Rules, subsection 2? A committee of conference shall meet on the call of either co-chairperson.
I don't believe there is anything within Joint Rule 3 that is in conflict with the open meetings law, thus requiring the 24-hour notice. And if there is not going to be the 24-hour notice, good cause. And then, and only then, can you come down to the 2 hours. And it's undisputed here, they did not make the 24-hour notice. There was no good cause given that we have heard about. And even if there was, they still didn't make the 2-hour notice.
It's not clear to me in the discussion of what are the Senate rules and what are the Assembly rules. Do we have those exact rules in our record?
I don't believe they're in front of you. They are with the Circuit Court, I believe.
In the final, not in the TRO.
Not in the TRO. I believe we submitted them, and I'd have to check. I believe we did.
Yeah, she made findings specifically then, referencing them, so you must have.
So that was in the ultimate decision here, but not in any of these proceedings. So we don't know if the Senate rules said Senate committees are governed as follows, and the Assembly rules said Assembly committees are governed as follows. And they may be mirror images of each other, but each, is that your understanding, that each governs their own committees?
That right? is my understanding.
And so they're not acting together. They're acting separate for their own rules. I mean, that's what I keep yes. hearing you saying. I didn't look at the rules, so I don't know what they say. And that when they have a committee that is joint, they have a special rule for the joint rather than mirror images. That's your position.
That's our position. I believe that's what the testimony was.
Okay. All right. Are there any further questions about that? Thank you, Mr. Ozahan. Jam Boys.
Good afternoon,
Your
Honors.
You're representing Representative Barca.
My name is Robert Jam Boys, and I represent Representative Peter Barca. I wanted to bring this court back to the issue which commenced this whole thing, and that is that this is a petition for a supervisory writ. And even if you were to call this an original action publici juris, it still would come back to this court exercising its superintendent control over the trial court. And it's my view, or actually in Petition of Heil, this court said that it will not exercise superintending control. It's only asserted when the lower court acts with flagrant and patent defiance of express or implied constitutional commands. Now, in view of the questions that this court has been posing to each of the people who have come up here before me, it is abundantly clear, it must be abundantly clear to every member of this court, that the lower court was not acting in flagrant and patent defiance of express or implied constitutional commands. On the contrary, the lower court was acting in a manner which it was entirely compliant with the statute, with the open meetings law, and with the constitutional provisions that the open meetings law relies upon. And how is it that this court knows that the open meetings law relies upon the Constitution? Because the legislature tells you so, and just as it told Judge Sumi this. And Judge Sumi has concurrent jurisdiction over issues of constitutional law. She did not act in flagrant patent disregard for the constitutional mandate. She was following it. And now if I could digress for just one moment and speak to what Justice Gableman had raised, and that was this issue of whether or not there was some rule, an assembly rule, a Senate rule, or a joint rule that authorized meetings with less than 24 hours notice. And there is no such rule. There is no assembly rule, there is no Senate rule, and there is no joint rule. The rule that Justice Gableman cited made reference to simply posting on a bulletin board. But it didn't say, which provides, by the way, the manner of notice. But it doesn't address the timing of the notice. And the notice is required to be given 24 hours in advance.
I think subsection 6 of the statute says you don't have to give any notice if there is such a rule. I think it was to connect those two that the Assembly and Senate rules were brought
up. And Justice Rogensack, thank you for you're raising the issue of 19.846, which, by the way, was never raised before the trial court. And there are a number of findings of fact that would need to be addressed if we were going to consider the applicability of 19.846.
Like what?
Such as the question of what kind of an assembly meeting was it? My understanding, and this would be something that I guess would be subject to further factual determination by a fact-finding court, is that the assembly only met in skeletal session. It wasn't a normal session, and Justice Prosser of the group of us in this room might know that better than anybody else. But when there's a skeletal session, there might only be two or three members of the assembly that actually meet. And the rest of the members of the assembly have no idea that it's meeting. But then if you even look at the documents that are a matter of record in this case, and by the way, you don't have the entire record, there were a number of exhibits that are in the trial court that are not before this court because there hasn't been an appeal. And if there is an appeal, then you would get all those exhibits. But if you look at the Senate journal, the Senate indicates, I think it was a special session, says they convened at 4 o'clock, they sent a message to the assembly, and the assembly, and the notice the assembly was, we're convening or we request a joint conference, a committee of conference. Now, that's what the Senate journal says. But then you look at the assembly journal, and that says they convened at 2 o'clock and adjourned at something like 2:02 p.m., and just before they adjourned at 2:02 p.m., they were acknowledging receipt of the message from the Senate, which wasn't even in session until 4 o'clock. So there are some substantial factual issues that would need to be addressed if we were going to start considering the provisions of Section 19.846. And those might be good questions, but they're not questions before this Court.
Well, I guess my question, Counselor, really went to my understanding of STIT, because I, just so you know where I'm coming from, if there's no constitutional violation, I think the legislature gets to decide if they applied their own rules correctly. Okay, and the trial court did make a finding that the Senate clerk, in direction from Senator Fitzgerald, posted a note on the bulletin board in reliance on Senate Rule 93-2. So if there's no, and I understand Mr. Ozan, and I understand his argument that there's a constitutional question. My concern was to try to separate the arguments out, and if in fact that's the rule they relied on, if in fact it was their own rule, and she made a finding they relied on it, under STIT we're done. We don't decide whether they applied their own rules correctly. So the findings you talk about may be cool if we're going to decide did they apply it correctly. I wouldn't decide if they applied it correctly. I'm concerned with the constitutional issue, but as far as whether they applied their rule correctly, I wouldn't go there, frankly.
And when you're talking about the separation of powers that you're referencing in La Follette versus Stitt,
right.
You know, in that case, they were simply talking about a matter of legislative process. They weren't talking about anything other than a matter of simple legislative process.
Right.
But in coming to that conclusion, that the court won't inquire into that.
Right.
The court made reference, in fact, cited Baker versus Carr. Well, Baker versus Carr does not stand for the proposition that under no circumstances will the judicial branch look at what the legislature has done. In Baker versus Carr, they issued six different criteria, and if any one of them are met, then that's considered a non-justiciable issue. That's an issue for the executive branch or the legislative branch. It's not an issue for the judicial branch. However, if you look at the six criteria that are listed in Baker versus Carr, they would have, at least two of them would have applied to prohibit review by the Supreme Court in La Follette versus Stitt. However, none of those six apply in this instance. If you look at the first one, which makes reference to whether or not there's been a specific delegation of authority to one constitutional branch or another, in this instance, the legislature itself has seen fit to confer upon the judicial branch the determination of whether or not a violation of the open meeting law occurred. What the district attorney did in this case certainly was not in patent excess of his constitutional authority. I mean, does anybody here suspect or suggest that the district attorney in this case acted in egregious or patent excess of his authority?
I don't think he's on trial here, Counselor. I think we're trying to figure out, did the legislature do it right?
I understand, but what is at issue is the question of the exercise of this court's superintending control of the lower court action. And that, in turn, before this court will exercise a superintending control over a lower court, that lower court or the party before that lower court must have acted in patent, flagrant excess of its constitutional authority.
Have you read our 2004 decision in State Exwell Ralph Nader versus Peter Camejo?
You know, I know of that case, and I haven't committed to memory, but my understanding was that in that case, there was an issue before the court where in just a matter of weeks there was going to be an election, and the Supreme Court had to take action very quickly. I believe what the court did in that instance is exercise its original jurisdiction and that its original, treated as an original action and exercised its superintending authority, just as it did, by the way, in State X. Well, Reynolds versus County Court, which where I'm from in Kenosha, we called that Bodie versus Lindgren, because that was the big issue between Bodie and Lindgren. And there, the only thing this court did was spring Mr. Lindgren from the county jail.
The only thing I was trying to point out to you is I think in the Nader case, we didn't say that Judge Nowakowski acted in flagrant disregard of anything we had told him to do. So I don't think that that's necessarily a criteria for exercising original jurisdiction. I don't think we said Judge Nowakowski did anything bad, except we didn't agree with his interpretation of the law. But.
Well, in Petition of Howe, what this court said, it laid out the circumstances under which it would exercise a superintending control. And it is true that when the court is exercising its original, when it's an original action, this court will exercise a superintending control in aid of that original action. For that matter, if it will exercise a superintending control in aid of its appellate jurisdiction as well. But in this instance, there is no reason for this court to exercise a superintending control because the trial court did not flagrantly exceed or patently exceed its constitutional authority. It followed the law. It followed the statutes. And the district attorney here followed the statutes in enforcing the law. Now, if you want to bring this around again to Petition of Heil, let's look at what we found out this morning, and that is that the Attorney General is actually acting in this case at the request of the governor. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with the governor asking the Attorney General to intervene in a matter, but doesn't that make this case really, if you want to recast it, you should recast it as Petition of Walker. And doesn't the case Petition of Walker sound an awful lot like the case of Petition of Heil? And this court in the past, it's not a question of exercising its power. It's a question of under what circumstances, what are the policies that this court is going to observe in deciding whether or not to exercise its power. And under Petition of Heil, you have indicated that you're not going to exercise your superintending control or supervisory power over a lower court at the behest of a non-party to the lower action. Now, the governor could have intervened in the lower court action. I believe the governor could have. I think the governor is a more promising intervening party than the secretary of the Department of Administration. For that matter, I believe the Attorney General could clearly have acted at the request of the Senate or the Assembly or the committee. They could have acted that way. And had they intervened in the lower court action in that fashion, then the Attorney General could have raised, for example, questions about 19.846 before the trial judge. But it didn't do that because the Attorney General was kind of playing this shell game. They were saying, oh, we don't represent any of these people, and they wouldn't reach out to represent anybody. They could have certainly gone to the Senate president or the Assembly, or perhaps the district attorney could have nominally named the Senate clerk or the Assembly clerk, as was suggested in the Lister case, that in order to find somebody to sue. But the fact of the matter is the open meetings law, if it doesn't mean anything to the Wisconsin legislature, during one of the most intense issues that have come up before this state in the last 40 or 50 years, then it doesn't mean anything ever. Had this Senate Conference Committee or this Joint Conference Committee occurred on March 10th, they could have, I mean, they were talking about this on March 7th. They scheduled on March 9th. They could have scheduled on March 9th to occur on March 10th. And why wouldn't they do that? There probably would have been 70 to 80,000 people surrounding this building had this meeting been scheduled for March 10th. And that was the reason. That's one of the reasons this court should act in this instance and dismiss this petition and allow this lower court proceeding to stand, or at least to be appealed. The clear inference to be drawn from the facts in this case is that the Senate President and the Senate Assembly Leader wanted to avoid the uproar, the public uproar associated with enacting this legislation. And you know, that's part of the democratic process. And when we're talking about deference, what really all of us owe deference to is the right of the people of the state of Wisconsin. We paid for this building. We own this room. We own the room that that table is located in. And when government business is being transacted at that table, we, the people, have a right to a seat at that table. And for these reasons, I would request that this court go back and look at what this is. It's a petition for a supervisory writ that's been filed at the request of Governor Walker. This is petition of Walker, and it should be dismissed. And then if these issues, these important substantive issues about comity, about separation of powers, if they need to be addressed, then, and if they're urgent, well, if they're urgent, the legislature can go back and reenact it the way they're supposed to. And if they're not urgent, then if it's just a matter of constitutional law, well, then it's something that could best be handled by appeal. Thank you.
And who do you suggest appeal?
Well, first of all, under Wisconsin's intervener statute, the governor could still intervene post-judgment, or the Senate could intervene. Post, they don't even need to intervene. They're still named as a party. So the Senate and the Secretary of State could appeal. And by the way, the Secretary of State, Doug LaFollette, might agree with Judge Sumi's decision, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have adverse interests. When the judiciary acts to tell him, to compel him from doing an act which the law requires him to do, he's an adverse party. He has an adverse interest, even though he may agree with what Judge Sumi has ordered him to do. Now, all that the Secretary of State did in this instance is comply with a restraining order. I don't see as how that means that he doesn't have an adverse interest. He was ordered by a court to withdraw the publication date, and that's what he did.
Are you familiar with State X. Rel. Barber versus Circuit Court for Marathon County? I think it must have been cited.
I am not familiar
somewhere.
With that case, Your Honor.
That preceded Nader, by the way, wasn't a couple of weeks. It was like tomorrow. In that case.
I should have read it more carefully.
Yeah.
That it was a ballot access case for Mr. Nader in a presidential, a primary? Presidential primary. Mm-hmm. We didn't cite this in Nader, but State X. Rel. Barber, which is the 1922 case, was an original action here, and it was also a ballot access case. And it had been in Marathon County. And the question was whether or not the county clerks of Lincoln and Marathon should place Joseph Barber on the ballot. And the court said no one asked about our authority. No one raised it, but that the court thought it was better practice and wiser to raise it and said, hey, this is a ballot. It didn't say hey. This is a ballot access question. There's no time. It's not quite right because it's already been in circuit court and there's no appeal, but we don't have any time to do it. And it has to be done right now. And right now, we're going to assume original jurisdiction. So you've got two cases. Both ballot access cases, both no time, both trial court. The court here says, okay, no time for appeal. Appeal is not an adequate remedy. You can come here.
Well, I like that case the more I've heard about it.
I knew you would.
I will say this. This court does not have an adequate record to really review what the trial court did. And if you wish to do that, by the way, I'm not questioning this court's power or this court's authority. I recognize the seven justices seated before me. If four of you decide, whatever you decide, that's what's going to happen. And if you decide you want to exercise your appellate jurisdiction, you can do that. If you want to recast this as an original action publica juris, you can do that as well. You certainly have the power to do it. But if you're going to exercise the power of utilizing your superintending control in aid of your appellate jurisdiction, I would request that you appeal, that you look at the whole thing. So at least order the circuit court to compile a record. And then order the circuit court to make it available to us parties so we can actually come in and look at it and determine whether we agree with the exhibits that were listed. And among those exhibits, by the way, are all the assembly rules, all the Senate rules, and the joint committee rules.
It's what we were talking about earlier with Mr. Ozan.
Yes.
Mr. Jambois, I looked earlier today again at the letter brief that you filed on Friday on behalf of Representative Barca. and you spent about 2.5 pages talking about the fact that there are a number of questions of fact. As you know, our case law makes it pretty clear that if there are issues of fact, we don't generally exercise our original jurisdiction. We don't get into the supervisory writ situation. The case that I looked at that I think is one of the more recent ones is a case called Green for Wisconsin versus State Elections Board, where we said just that. And I'm wondering, because it's lengthy, if you can maybe summarize for us the issues of fact that you're detailing at some length in pages 4, 5, and 6 of your letter brief.
So please, as you read my letter, read so carefully. Let me pull it up so I make sure I don't misquote it.
Well, notice I didn't quote you.
It was some of my best work, but of course it was done in concert with my wife, so my partner in this case. Well, there are actually a number.
Just so we're all on the same letter, we've got a lot of documents. June 3, 2011?
Yes. I believe that's what he's referring to.
Paragraph 5.
All right.
Yes. And, well, I don't want to revisit everything that's in here because I don't want to reread that. But I would say let's just talk about what was raised here today, 19.846. That entails a number of facts regarding the special session and the regular session of the Assembly, the regular session and the special Senate or session of the Senate. It entails questions of fact about what was actually said and when they and how they actually met. And you know, the journal entries, which are part of the lower court record, not before this court, I don't believe, they say things that raise additional questions of fact and maybe things that we would have gone into on cross-examination. If I'd have known, for example, that there was a question about 19.846, I would have conducted a far different longer cross-examination of Senate Clerk Rob Marchant. I would have conducted a more extensive cross-examination of the Assembly Clerk as well. Those are things that we weren't allowed to go in, that we didn't go into, because the question of 19.846 and its applicability had not been raised below. But there are a wide range of other facts. The question is the effect of publication, the question of whether or not the Secretary of State has the authority to rescind a previous act. The Attorney General has made the argument that, oh, no, he can't rescind a previous act because there's no express statutory authority for him to do that. Well, I would point out there's also no express statutory authority for the Secretary of the Department of Administration to rescind a previous statement that they were going to implement 2011 Wisconsin Act 10. There's no express statutory authorization for him to do that. And when I looked in the statutes regarding rescission, there was only one part of the statutes where I could find where an elected official or a public officer was not able to rescind a previous act. And that's where somebody's running for elective office and says, if you vote for me, I won't take my full salary. Well, if somebody runs under that pretense and then they get elected, they can't turn around and say, oh, I changed my mind. There's a provision in Chapter 66 about that. Then this court has also ruled that when property rights are transferred to or from somebody, an unwilling party, then you can't rescind an act that undoes the transfer of property. So there are limitations on rescission, but none of them apply with respect to the Secretary of State's actions in this case. There are questions of fact regarding the communications between the Senate President and the Attorney General's office, between the Senate President and the Legislative Reference Bureau. There are a number of questions of fact that would need to be addressed by this court if it were going to take this matter as original action publici juris. And you would need, and by the way, you have on some occasions taken cases where there were questions of fact, and Lightborn comes to question. But what did you do under those circumstances? You appointed a special master, and as I recall, it took something like 18 months before this whole thing was resolved. Now, I agree that Lightborn case was significantly more complicated than this, but this case is pretty complicated too. But the question, the first question, is not at all complicated. If you go back to the question of under what circumstances do you issue a petition or grant a petition for a supervisory writ, the answer is found in Petition of Heil. So don't, in this case, which now should be denominated Petition of Walker, don't reverse 72 years of case law, because it has stood this court in good stead up until this point. And I think it stands in good stead now.
It's interesting. Goodland, too, was a governor.
Pardon me?
Goodland, too, was the acting governor at that time.
Okay.
Yes, we had two cases where the governor was the petitioner.
Every once in a while, the governors get dissatisfied with Dane County courts. That's, you know, that, and that in Petition of Heil is a Dane County court that the, that Governor Heil was dissatisfied with. And, you know, if you look at Petition of Heil, this court can take judicial notice of what the law, what was going on in 1938 in the United States. There were, we were in the midst of a depression. People were dissatisfied. They voted in a whole slate of new candidates, a new governor, a new majority in the Senate and Assembly. And some Dane County court did something that the governor didn't like. And that's really what we have right here today. And I'm not minimizing the importance or the magnitude of the authority of the governor of the state of Wisconsin. I understand that the governor has, he's got some pretty big issues to address. And the legislature has some pretty big issues to address as well. And you know, anybody who believes in the legislative process would be concerned with the judiciary stepping in when there's something the legislature does that they find difficult to swallow. But that's not the case here. Had this committee met on March 10th at 4:30 p.m., none of us would be here before this court. And by the way, unlike the cases involving the elections, the Attorney General is not asking you to act promptly. They're asking you to act retroactively, back to March 25th of 2011. I think there's a wide range of reasons for this court not to act under these circumstances. And there were additional facts, Your Honor, that were raised by, in the amicus briefs. There's a great number of facts that this court would need to address before it decides this matter. And it doesn't have the record before it to do so now. And there's no reason to think that appellate jurisdiction and appellate relief would not be sufficient for any of the parties and for that non-parties who wish to intervene below. Wisconsin has a very liberal intervener statute. It's intended to serve the appellate process. So let it do so. Let there be an appeal on this matter. And let this court take this issue up in good time with all of the information that's necessary in order to address all of these many, many questions that the justices have had for the people that have come here before me. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. Attorney Lester Pines, representing Senator Mark Miller.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Yesterday was my birthday.
Happy birthday!
Thank you. I didn't think that I'd come here and be made to feel old through the argument, but it turns out
he's older.
It turns out, not from that, it turns out that I was involved in the Nader case, in the Green case, in the Lightborn case, and a number of other cases that have been before you.
You do it right the first time.
I want to talk about the Nader case, because the Nader case actually should focus this court on what it should do in this instance. That case came before this court in about 72 hours. In fact, the court ordered briefs, I believe it was sometime about
Thursday noon on September 29th.
Thank
That's
you.
What we
ordered. the brief had to be prepared very, very quickly. The reason that the brief had to be prepared so quickly is because there was a tremendous exigency. And, you know, we talked, Justice Roginsack, I remember, we talked in the oral argument about whether there was a final order or not. The written order hadn't even been signed yet.
Written order of the trial court.
Of the trial court. And this court took up that case because It was essentially an emergency because a circuit court judge had said, we're going to keep Ralph Nader off the ballot. And it came to this court, and the argument that that we made was, you know, they didn't come to the right court. They should have come first to the Court of Appeals. And this court decided, under the circumstances, with that kind of exigency where the public might be denied a right to vote for a candidate, we have to act, and we have to act right away. And frankly, it was the right decision. This case doesn't share that exigency. This case doesn't have an urgency to it. And in fact, the conduct of the parties, the conduct of the Attorney General, the conduct of the legislators who exercise their privilege not to appear, displays a lack of urgency. This legislation was passed in early March. There was an immediate complaint about an open meetings violation. The court held a hearing, and I want to say the court, which has been subjected to tremendous criticism for doing its job, the court, the circuit court, deserves a lot of credit for doing its job, not criticism. This matter was brought before the court. There were no irregularities in how the court proceeded. When the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, was asked to list irregularities, he listed for you things that the state objected to about how things turned out. But he didn't describe a single irregularity. The hearings were properly noticed. The parties knew what they were going to talk about. They were given the opportunity to argue all of the issues. They were given the opportunity to brief the issues. There were 2 days of testimony taken. There was nothing irregular about the way that the circuit court proceeded. The circuit court was asked to issue a temporary restraining order. She heard full arguments from the parties. And Justice Ziegler, you are a circuit court judge. You know sometimes people come in for temporary restraining orders. Justice Crooks, you experienced that as well. Justice Bradley, you did too. The circuit court judge is asked for a decision on a request. The court has to determine on the factors before the court what to do. Judge Sumi did that. She determined that there was a reasonable probability of success on the merits of the claim. That was her finding. She found that there was going to be irreparable harm if the temporary restraining order was not issued. She made those findings after everybody had a chance to make their case to her, and she issued the temporary restraining order. The Attorney General's office at that point had a choice to make. It made a choice to appeal. It made a choice, obviously a strategic choice, not to seek early on in this case an original action in this court. It has yet to seek an original action in this court.
When you say original action, counsel, it's my understanding that we have original jurisdiction and appellate jurisdiction. With original jurisdiction, you have publici juris and you have supervisory writs.
The statute refers to original actions.
Yes, I know that.
And original actions, and I'm making a distinction because I think the language sometimes gets a little fuzzy. The original jurisdiction of the court allows it to issue writs, such as the one that's requested here. Parties can seek an original action, can seek to start an action in this court. Parties can come here for an appeal. So if we think about an original action, It's part of the court's original jurisdiction. An original action, a declaratory judgment action, could have been started in this court. It could have been started in this court, even though the circuit court had an action going. There was a strategic decision made not to do that, apparently. In State Exeral Thompson versus Craney, there had been an action started in the circuit court, which was called Fish versus Thompson, where Odie Fish and another bunch of plaintiffs sued Governor Thompson on the question of the powers of the superintendent of public instruction. While briefs had been filed on a motion for summary judgment in that case, Governor Thompson started an original action, declaratory judgment action, in this court, denominated Thompson versus Craney. This court issued a stay of the circuit court's action, directed the parties to come to a stipulation of fact or inform the court that there were no facts in dispute, and this court took that matter up. That was in 1995. That process was available to the Attorney General, to the governor, if they had wanted to do that. It was available to the legislators if they had wanted to do that, but apparently a strategic decision was made not to do that. So what we're facing here is a request for a supervisory writ where there is no exigency. There's no emergency. And what did the Attorney General do? The Attorney General came before this court and represented to the court a series of facts in the petition. The court asked us in its letter, in its order last Thursday, to address whether there were disputed issues of fact. And in our response that we filed on Friday, we listed at page 7 the facts that we dispute. And the facts that are disputed are the facts that the Attorney General alleged in the petition as to why there was an exigent circumstance here. And we dispute each and every one of those assertions. And in the argument today, we didn't hear from the Attorney General that there was an emergency, that there was an exigency. In the absence of that.
This is your June 3 letter.
Our June 6th letter, page 7. June 3rd. I printed out a
copy
today.
Today is the 6th.
Yeah, today's the 6th. June 3rd letter.
Happy birthday yesterday.
Yep. Thanks.
And it's sub 5, whether any facts beyond those found by the circuit court material. Okay.
Right. So none of these facts do we concede. So what is the rush here? There is no rush. What is the harm to the public here? There is no harm to the public. There were strategic decisions made, and the court is now being asked to relieve the parties of those strategic decisions. One of those strategic decisions that was made was a decision by Representative Fitzgerald, Senator Ellis, and Representative Souter to exercise their privilege. They said, we have a privilege under the Constitution not to participate in this proceeding. They were not forced to exercise that privilege. They chose to exercise that privilege. They can waive that privilege now if they want. They can come in and appeal this case if they want to do that. But this is a circumstance of where they want their cake and they want to eat it too. They want to say, we don't want to participate. We're going to exercise our privilege. But we want you to take this case up because we want you to decide there's nobody to appeal this case because we're not there. They made that choice. This court should not relieve them of that choice. And there are plenty of people available to appeal this case, to bring this case up in the normal course of events. And why is it important that this case be heard? The governor can intervene. The governor could have intervened at any point in this process to assert the interests of the state in the circuit court. The governor has authorized the attorney general to appear here today. The governor authorized the attorney general to file this petition. The governor can intervene, can bring this matter before the court. Here, on these expedited briefing schedules, on partial records, we are arguing this case involving an extraordinary claim by the attorney general. I mean, a truly breathtaking claim that the open meetings law, a statute passed by the legislature, which has a presumption of constitutionality which can only be overcome by showing that it is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. That we are here arguing on these expedited briefs on that and the extraordinary claim by the Attorney General that that law, which has been in existence for decades, cannot constitutionally be applied to the legislature. That is an extraordinary claim.
I don't think he says it cannot constitutionally be applied. I think what he said is there isn't a constitutional violation here.
No, I think that what he's saying, what the Attorney General's argument was, and I mean, obviously he'll correct me because he'll say I'm wrong in the way that I'm characterizing it, but the open meetings law was adopted by the legislature. It's constitutional.
Sure.
I mean, and it says it will be applied to us on these terms. And the Attorney General is coming here and saying it cannot be applied to us on these terms. That's a violation of a separation of powers. That's a claim that statute is unconstitutional as it's applied to the legislature.
Well, it can't be mandatorily applied. The statute says shall everywhere, or most of the places, right? So shall to the legislature. But the Attorney General is arguing it's aspirational as to the legislature. As to the legislature, it means may, if it wants.
What the Attorney General is essentially saying, an aspirational statute is a statute that has absolutely no meaning.
Well,
we think that we'd like to do this, so we'll give the district attorney the right to enforce this against us. We'll give circuit courts the power to issue declaratory judgment actions about our conduct. We'll give the circuit courts the power to issue injunctions about our conduct. We'll give the circuit court the power to issue writs about our conduct. They put that in 1987. But then when it comes down to it being applied to them, the Attorney General comes in and says, yeah, we gave the court the power to issue injunctions. We gave the court the power to issue declaratory judgments. We gave the court the power to issue writs. We gave the court the power. We gave the district attorney the power to investigate. We gave the court the power to make findings of fact and conclusions of law. But you know what? That was all aspirational. We really didn't mean it when it came to us. We really didn't mean that, you know. You're trying to force it against us now, even though we gave you all these powers? Well, that was just aspirational.
Counselor, let's step back from that argument a little bit. I want to see what your thoughts are on separating out what I perceive to be the two parts of STIT. Okay, one part has to do with the legislature deciding what rules they're going to apply in their internal processing.
Right.
The other part is the constitutional argument. And frankly, for me, the constitutional question is a separate inquiry. But in regard to the first part, given the finding that the clerk was instructed to post notices on the bulletin board, the finding of the circuit court number 15 that he relied on Senate Rule 93 sub 2 when he did that, given the part of the open meetings law that says if there's a rule of a body, then there is no notice required, okay? So if you have those facts, why, under STIT, would we look further? Don't get to the constitutional thing, because I think that's very complicated. But just if that's all you have and there's no claim by Mr. Ozan or anyone else that there was a constitutional violation by what they did, you wouldn't go any further, would you?
Well,
you just say, well, they picked that rule. It's their own rule, and we don't figure out whether they applied it correctly.
I believe, first of all, Let me just take a step back. First of all, on the request for writ, we wouldn't be dealing with the findings of fact. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't even be getting to these, but we'll get to them.
Well, they asked to have the record supplemented. We supplemented the record, so we've got them as part of our record,
okay,
too.
So here they are. So there's the finding of fact.
Right.
I think the finding of fact is much less clear than you seem to be interpreting it.
Okay.
The 1984 sub 2, I believe it is, mm-hmm, requires 24-hour notice. It requires notice to the news media. And I can quote it exactly.
I know the statute.
Okay.
It's
notice to the news media. I believe that that's what Marchant was telling Fitzgerald, and I think that's what this finding of fact is. That's the advance notice, because it goes on to say, notice of a committee meeting is not required other than posting on the legislative bulletin board.
Right, which you
that's
did.
That's the manner of the notice, not the timing of the notice. This finding of fact is not dispositive on the timing.
The timing goes to subsection 6 of the statute, which says no notice is required. 1984 sub 6 says no notice.
1984 sub 6 is not the statute that governs this. Then we get into the issue of your reading of that section of the statutes and whether it applies to these circumstances, which the district attorney didn't allege and which the findings.
It's my view that reading the statute, and if the legislature relied on 93.2, we don't figure out whether they fit together perfectly because they're all internal rules for the legislature. And what I'm trying to get from you is, look at Stitt, and am I misreading Stitt in my thought that 1984.6 says no notice? There's a finding that they relied on Senate Rule Number 93, Subsection 2, and it just says no notice of hearing before shall be required other than a posting on the bulletin board. So they posted it on the bulletin board, and she made a finding onto that as well. So if that's what they relied on, why do we look at it further? She looked at it further.
And my contention, and I believe it's also the contention of the district attorney, is that 1984 sub 2 says, every public's notice of a meeting of a governmental body shall set forth the time, date, place, and subject matter of the meeting, including the intended for consideration at any contemplated closed session in such form as is reasonably likely to apprise members of the public and the news media thereof. And that what Marchant's statement to Fitzgerald was, all we need to do to comply is to post on the bulletin board, which is a limitation on the obligation of the legislature to apprise the members of the public and the news media, because that's all they had to do, was post it there. But that doesn't address 3, which is public notice of every meeting of a governmental body shall be given at least 24 hours prior to the commencement of the meeting, unless for good cause.
Subsection 6 says notwithstanding the requirements, okay, of Section 1983, which is meetings of governmental bodies. So
no, meetings of a governmental body which is formally constituted subunit of a parent body may conduct a meeting without public notice as required by this section during a lawful meeting of the parent governmental body. There was no finding. There was no claim.
It's during, you have to read further. It said it can also occur during a recess. I think there was.
There was no claim at any time before the circuit court that this section of the statute governed what had been done by the joint committee.
Then why was there a finding made that Marchant relied on Rule 93.2, which provides when in special session, quote, notice of a committee meeting is not required other than posting on a legislative bulletin board?
Because the finding was directed not to timing, but to the manner in which the notice is disseminated. That's why the court made that finding.
Okay.
Frankly, Justice Rogenczyk, this exemplifies why this case ought to be considered in a way that is not done in a rush, as this case has had to end up being done. so that these issues can be fully determined, because this is a monumental question of whether or not the legislature violated the open meetings law, and it ought to be done in a careful way. And these issues ought to be thrashed out in a careful way. I mean, one of the things that we have not talked about is the part of the statute that says the statute is to be liberally construed in favor of open meetings. And whether or not by reading such as you're suggesting, whether that's a liberal construction or whether that is a more constrained construction. And I think that also goes to some of the questions that Justice Gableman asked of the prior counsel who were here. I think the court is supposed to give an expansive and liberal construction to this, not a constrained construction of it. And that's an issue which has not been addressed and briefed here as well. So I think that the case is not appropriately before this court for decision. I want to suggest to the court as well that there are institutional reasons why the court should not issue a writ in this case. There is a lot of misunderstanding about the role of the courts. And there's been a lot of discussion through this case and publicly about the separation of powers. And the separation of powers obviously is an important concept, but with that concept comes the concept of checks and balances. And in all the public discussion about this case, I've heard a lot about separation of powers, but I haven't heard anything about checks and balances. And from an institutional standpoint, what the court has before it is this circumstance. A circuit court judge, and let me say, Justice Siegler, in answer to your question about why did Justice Sumi act as she did in terms of making findings of fact, no one asked this court to issue a stay. There was no stay, and there was no indication from the court as to when it might, in fact, take up this matter, if ever. And although one could assume that the court might have, no one knew whether the court would or not. And it may very well have been, and I can't speak for Judge Sumi, but it may well have been that the fact that when these matters are pending before the court and the court did not stay the circuit court, she may very well have assumed that the court intended for her to continue whatever proceedings there were in that court. I can't speak for her, but there are two sides to that story. There are two possible explanations for that. This court has concurrent jurisdiction with the circuit courts on matters publici juris. She was exercising her jurisdiction, assuming this is a matter of publici juris. And she continued to do what it was her job to do. And frankly, to suggest that there was anything irregular about what she did or that a writ needs to be issued about her conduct is really something the court should be very, very careful about doing. Because in the absence of something significant or irregular, in the absence of a legal decision which is so far out of the mainstream that it can't be countenanced by this court, in the absence of some other misconduct by the circuit court, this court should be very, very, very cautious, especially in an environment where the circuit court has been vilified. This court should be very cautious about issuing any kind of a supervisory writ, and I suggest that you shouldn't do it and that you should allow the normal process of appeal, the normal development of a record to happen. And finally, let me say this. Most certainly, when the legislature passes a law, and especially a law which undoes 50 years of collective bargaining relationships and imposes new obligations on tens of thousands of state employees, certainly that is a serious matter. Likewise, it's a very serious matter when legislators are accused of violating the open meetings law. The key here is that the legislature was free to say, we disagree with the court. We disagree with the circuit court. We maintain our contention that the open meetings law was not violated. But in an exercise of abundant caution, because we respect the judicial branch just as we expect the judicial branch to respect us, in an exercise of abundant caution, we will take this bill up again. We will give 24 hours notice. We will provide access. The bill is passed, and the public policy is made. Instead, this court is faced with an insistence by the legislature that we did nothing wrong, and you have to tell the circuit court that she was wrong because we're not going to do anything to correct the problem. And here we are 3 months later and the bill still isn't law. Why? Why? Because the legislators are standing on principle that they didn't do anything wrong. So if there's any problem, if there's any exigency, if there's tens of millions of dollars being lost, it's not the circuit court's fault. It's the legislature's fault. Likewise, it bears repeating. It's not just this court which interprets the law. It's the legislature that interprets the law. Judge Sumi made a decision, and she said the open meetings law applies to the legislature, and she said the open meetings law was violated in A, B, C, D, and E reason. If the legislature doesn't agree with that, it doesn't need the Supreme Court to come in and say Judge Sumi was wrong. The legislature has tremendous power. It wrote the law. If it doesn't think the judge was right, it can amend the law. The legislature could pass a law tomorrow that says no judge has the power to do anything that Judge Sumi did and join the publication of a law, void a legislative enactment, or anything. The legislature could do that. It doesn't need your help. It doesn't need your help. And finally, it certainly doesn't need you to take up a significant constitutional question when the record has not been fully formed, and when the parties have not had to do their presentations to you on an expedited basis. So there are plenty of reasons to deny the writ. There are plenty of reasons to say.
Is this the fourth, finally, Mr. Pines?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe I'm getting senile.
Well, happy birthday again.
And this is the final.
And if this goes on much longer, we'll be with you in time to celebrate it next time, too.
I do want to say, Justice Gableman, that we have now surpassed the record of the Lightbourne case for the longest oral argument in the history of the I am concluding my argument.
You should go to District 3, where I subbed when I was on the Court of Appeals. They have no time limits. One afternoon, we had like a 4.5-hour argument. I mean, they didn't have time limits. So,
well,
depends what court you're in.
In the Seventh Circuit, you get 10 minutes, the light goes off,
that's
you
right.
Sit down.
That's right. Absolutely.
You're not quite. We had a case, it was a criminal case on sentencing credit. Both the state and the defendant agreed, talking about aggrieved parties and adversarial proceedings, both the defendant and the Attorney General's office agreed how many days credit he should get. The court did not agree. We had a 2-hour argument. Not as long as this, but we didn't have as many parties either, and the parties agreed. So that may have been a record, but we're on our way again. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For your
attention. Are there any other questions? No. All right. Thank you. Attorney Roger Sage, representing Douglas LaFollette.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been in front of Justice Bradley and Justice Crooks as trial court judges, so that does age me a little bit, but it's a pleasure to see both you justices on the bench here. I'm here to tell you, I'm Attorney Roger Sage. I represent Secretary of State LaFollette. I'm here to assert the proposition that 2011 Wisconsin Act 10 has not been published within the authority of the Secretary of State, and that the court in this whole process could make a factual determination that 2011 Wisconsin Act 10 has not been published. If the court does that and finds, as a matter of fact, that the act has not been published, we do not get to the issues of whether the circuit court had authority to enjoin the implementation of the act before it was published. We don't have to address the Goodland issues. We don't have to address whether the court had authority or did the, if the court did have authority, that the Secretary of State, whether the Secretary of State had the discretion to rescind an earlier designated date. We don't have to get to the issue of whether the Secretary of State was required to rescind an earlier designated date. And we don't have to get to the issue of, even if the court ordered and the Secretary of State rescinded, whether the Legislative Reference Bureau had the independent authority to publish regardless of these acts, and a corollary to that, and if so, whether the Legislative Reference Bureau was bound by the order or not. The court could simply determine whether this court or the lower court has erroneously exercised its jurisdiction in the exercise of its appellate appeal jurisdiction and determine an appropriate remedy for that.
So what do we have to decide? To just say decide nothing else but one thing?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that this court would obviously still get to the issue, which I think is the underlying issue and was raised by Justice Prosser and by yourself, Justice Abramson, that the underlying real issue in this case is whether the open meeting law was violated, which, as Attorney Jamboy, Attorney Pines, and I think Attorney Ozan have pointed out, we really have an inadequate factual record to make that factual determination at this point. And if so, if there was a violation of the open meeting law, whether the remedy was proper that was applied. As Justice Prosser pointed out, there is a real question here. What happens if this law, as asserted by the Attorney General, has been published and continues to be in effect? What do we do then? Can we go back? And if there is an ultimate determination that there was an erroneous exercise of the court's discretion to grant a temporary order enjoining publication, and if in fact it was published by the Legislative Reference Bureau after the temporary order, but before the temporary injunction, what do we do then? Do we have to try to obtain retroactive relief? Do state employees then owe money to the state treasury? That we've got to revisit all of those issues. I submit that if the law has not been published, and I submit that as a matter of fact, the law has not been published as we are sitting here today, because the law has not been enacted under the been published under the authority of the Secretary of State of the State of Wisconsin. And I'm happy to go into all of those issues. I would like to leave, obviously, some time for the justices to ask questions regarding that, but I do have a presentation regarding why I think that is the case, why the Secretary of State's participation in the process has not taken place and why it must take place in order for the law to be enacted. First of all, I would suggest, and I think it's quite clear and it's been in all the briefs, that the specific reference to the actions of the Secretary of State in Wisconsin Statute 99111 and 350951B require the, and under 395.0951B and 3B, require the Secretary of State's participation in the publication of an act. I don't think there's any question without that participation, an act cannot become law. I would say plainly publication of an act by the Legislative Reference Bureau alone under the section which was referenced in its in the March 25 enactment that we have in the record. I believe it's Appellate Record 1. There is a reference there to separate publication activities under Section Wisconsin Statute 350953A. But it must be respectfully pointed out that Wisconsin Statute 99111 and the concomitant duties of the Secretary of State referenced in Section 99111, which are 395-0951B, do not refer to the activities of the Legislative Reference Bureau at all. And if the legislator intended for publication to be achieved solely by the Legislative Reference Bureau, the statutes, the enabling statute, Section 99111, and would have cross-referenced the Legislative Reference Bureau's publication duties as well as the Secretary of State's duties, and it obviously did not reference those issues at all. I would also point out that on March 18th, it is in the record, it's Appellate Record 104, I believe, the Wisconsin State, the Legislative Reference Bureau received a copy of the Secretary of State's letter rescinding the earlier designation date, along with the court's, the Circuit Court's restraining order, and that would be on March 8th, prior to the Legislative Reference Bureau's actions, which were taken on March 25th. And that is in the appellate record before this court on pages 315, 343, 345, and 376.
When you say appellate record, what are you referring to?
The record on filed by with the petition for supervisory writ.
Okay.
Which is the only, I believe, record.
The only record here.
Been supplied, correct. And I would also ask, I think that the court does have to look at the pattern or procedure that has led up to this in terms of the duties of the Legislative Reference Bureau and how that has been interpreted over the years. The Legislative Reference Bureau has a pattern or a practice which has been an accepted pattern of practice throughout the years. And in the underlying circuit court case, which is in our appellate record at page 121, and that's in the petition for supervisory writ, the Legislative Reference Bureau chief, Mr. Miller, testified that in his opinion the actions of the Legislative Reference Bureau did not make 2011 Wisconsin Act 10 effective.
Well, that's his legal opinion.
That is his opinion.
Doesn't bind us.
It does not bind you, but I would respectfully submit that it is the pattern or practice of the administrative agency, in this case the Legislative Reference Bureau.
So, counsel, what is your client asking us for in regard to publication?
Secretary of State LaFollette.
I don't mean whether it should be public. I mean the ministerial duty, which I understand your client to have in regard to the form and the date within the confines of the statute. What is your client asking us for in regard to publication?
First of all, you did indicate that you felt that the Secretary of State's duties are ministerial.
Well, he doesn't get to decide whether to publish a law, does he? He has to publish a law. If certain preconditions have met, he gets to name a date or a time when it gets published.
That is correct. His role is to designate the publication date.
I meant no disrespect by the term ministerial.
I didn't take it that way, but I just wanted to mention that the Secretary of State feels, and I believe that that is law, that he has the discretion with regard to the designation of a publication date. I don't think there's any issue that has been raised with regard to his discretion in that respect.
And he did that. He did that. Then he got.
He initially did that.
Then he was ordered by the court, no publication, right?
That is correct.
And he adhered to a order of the court.
That's correct. On March 18th, he rescinded that order and informed the Legislative Reference Bureau that the act was not to be published under his authority.
And whether that order was correct or not, he had to obey it because otherwise there's a potential of contempt.
That is his position.
And the defense on contempt is that the order isn't any good. You're supposed to obey it and also seek review of it. Isn't that right?
That's
correct.
Isn't
that the general rule? Okay.
I inferred from your earlier comments that the way the LRB proceeded was not, in your client's estimation, the proper kind of publication. True?
Yes.
So what is he asking us for?
The Secretary of State is asking that the court find that the act has not been published, since the act has not been published under his authority.
Counsel, can you help me with the language of the statute, 35095 sub 3? Sub A says the Legislative Reference Bureau, and it uses the word shall, publish every act and every portion of an act that's enacted by the legislature within 10 working days after its enactment, right?
That's correct.
Sub B talks about the Secretary of State's duties, and the Secretary of State shall designate a date of publication for each act and every portion of the act enacted by the legislature. The date of publication may not be more than 10 working days after the date of enactment. Do you think those two sections are in conflict at all?
I would propose that they should be read together, but that it's clear that the Legislative Reference Bureau does not have the ability to independently publish a law in the constitutional sense such that it is enacted, because Section 991.11 of the Wisconsin statutes requires that the publication for a law to take effect must be under the 35095 3B section, which is right after the 3A section that you're reading from, which that is the section that requires the Secretary of State to designate the publication date. It does not reference the Legislative Reference Bureau. So the Legislative Reference Bureau cannot publish an act independently such that it becomes law or it meets the requirements to be published in the constitutional sense, because Section 991.11 does not reference the power of the Legislative Reference Bureau. It references the power of the Secretary of State. That's clear.
Mr. Sage, is it your position on behalf of your client that we should take this case exercising our original jurisdiction? Is it your position that we should take this case only if it comes to us as an appeal, or that we should not take this case at all? What basically is your client's position?
The Secretary of State's position, been set forth in the briefs, is that he believes that the circuit court process should take place, that there should be an adequate factual record, and that there should be an appeal from that record. And I do agree with other counsel who have indicated that there is, I think, a very strong ability of any party who feels aggrieved by this by the circuit court action to file a motion to intervene or come into that action and appeal it. Now, perhaps the Court of Appeals will certify that up to the Supreme Court. There would be a complete record, but I believe that's the proper way to proceed.
From your clients?
I note in the letter brief that you filed on Friday, the 3rd of June, that you spend about 2.5 pages setting forth issues of fact. And you start out by saying Secretary La Follette disputes the following factual or mixed factual and legal assertions made in the record before the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. Are those assertions that you're referring to made by the state?
That's correct. All of these assertions were made in the motion for leave to withdraw appeal, withdraw the petition for leave to appeal, and I believe also there was some of the assertions were made in the petition for supervisory writ. And these are assertions that were made by the Attorney General's office that the act has now been published, regardless of anything that this court does at this point, regardless of anything that the circuit court has done, that the act was published on March 16th by virtue of the independent actions of the Legislative Reference Bureau, which the Secretary of State strongly disputes.
Well, I've forgotten. In the circuit court, in the temporary restraining order hearing, was there any finding about why the LRB published this? Or I shouldn't say published in quotes.
There is a record in this appeal court record that indicates that Mr. Miller of the Legislative Reference Bureau was contacted by Senator Fitzgerald and thereafter spoke with one of the attorney generals about whether or not the Legislative Reference Bureau should go ahead and take this action independently, and a determination apparently was made by Mr. Miller after consultation with the Attorney General's office that they should go ahead and take the action under 350953A, which the Secretary of State disagrees with. So that's how that occurred, and I think it's plain from the testimony of, I believe, Mr. Harmon and Mr. Miller in the appellate court record, which is before this court.
And they believe, if I recall from that record, that they did not publish it as required by the law.
The official, as Justice Abramson, I guess the opinion of Mr. Miller and also the attorney for the Legislative Reference or Legislative Council have both weighed in on this issue, and they both have indicated that the act has not been published and that the actions of the Legislative Reference Bureau under Section 35.0953A did not result in publication of the of Act 2000, Wisconsin Act 11 in the constitutional sense, since that whole process disregarded the authority and the participation of the Secretary of State.
Counselor, aren't all those things that you list, and I'm just looking at your letter, questions of law? In other words, questions of fact, I always think, are like, was the traffic light red or green? They're kind of historic. But what you've done is kind of encapsulated things that have occurred but then have concluded that there wasn't publication sufficient in a constitutional sense.
Well, the reason that I have, and I do indicate that they may be mixed facts of question, mm-hmm. of mixed questions of fact and law, because I'm not quite so sure exactly what they actually get to. However, there is assertions, and I believe they're factual assertions, that the act was published. Now, I think the Attorney General is taking the position that the act was, quote, published in the constitutional sense, and the act has now become law. Secretary of State La Follette takes issue with that. That is why I believe, if that is the factual assertion, and that's really what all of these issues go to, Secretary of State takes issue with that factual assertion that the law has been published.
Right, but I think historically we know what happened. We know about his rescission, whether you think it's good or not, is a question of law. We know that it was put up on the web electronically by the LRB, whether that's publication or not. I mean, that's a question of law. So I think historically we know what occurred. What we don't know is what does all that mean, correct?
Well, I would be happy to present my case for why the Secretary of State can rescind.
I think you've set out the issue, but to me, we know what he did. We know the letter he sent. We know the circumstances of it. We know when he first sent out the date of publication and stuff. So, I don't know. To me, when I read these, all they frankly look like questions of law to me, not questions of fact.
Counsel, discussion occurred today about who's going to appeal, who can appeal, why haven't people appealed. As I recall reading your response letter of last week, you indicated you could appeal, but you're not sure you're going to appeal. Now that all this time has passed, 4 or 5 days, I suppose, have you made a decision?
No decision has been made. However, I will state this. The Secretary of State may appeal this decision for no other reason other than for asking an appellate court to make a determination and to clear up this confusion as to whether the Legislative Reference Bureau has independent authority to publish an act of the Wisconsin legislature. I think that's an important issue that may well be raised by appeal by the Secretary of State, because I don't think that it is in the best interest of the state of Wisconsin or the office of the Secretary of State to have this particular cloud or issue hanging over whether or not the Legislative Reference Bureau, irregardless of what the Secretary of State does, take control of the legislative designation of the date of publication and actually publish laws. The Secretary of State takes great issue with that.
Question,
and that could be an appeal issue.
A question asked this morning by Justice Rogensack, I echo this afternoon. You need to be an aggrieved party. How can you be an aggrieved party, or how do you claim to be an aggrieved party that would enable you to appeal?
I'm not an appellate lawyer. However, if my reading of the statutes are that you could move to intervene if you're an aggrieved party, but the Secretary of State is a party to this action.
But you won. That's right.
The Secretary, if there's...
I mean, I don't know where we are, whether the TRO or the... I mean, we shift from record to record, so I don't know. But if you look at the last thing, didn't you win?
No, I would say not. Not because this issue is still out there, and it has not been decided. And it has been raised by the Attorney General. There was an article in the paper that irregardless of what the Secretary of State did, this act is now law. And that reflects on the office of the Secretary of State. I think it behooves the Secretary of State to ask that be clarified and that his authority be clarified.
And I'm sorry. What you won on is that the law is, or somebody won on, is that budget repair bill was not validly enacted and therefore could be voidable under the Act, and it was so declared void. But you're saying that the trial court did not clarify the relationship of the Secretary of State to the LRB. Is that what you're telling
me? No, the Secretary of State does not feel that the Office of the Secretary has won on this appeal. The Secretary of State has never taken a position that whether or not the open records law was violated or what the remedies ought to be. And the Secretary
is with the LRB, and not necessarily with the LRB, but whether or not they can do something without you.
That is correct. And the Secretary does not feel that the Secretary of State ought to take a position on whether or not there was a factual violation of law and what the remedies ought to be.
But as to the powers of the Secretary of State, that you are aggrieved in the sense that it's not clarified.
That is correct.
Okay. I misunderstood that. Thank you. Justice Prosser.
A bill is passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. And then what happens to the bill?
At that point, the bill is sent to the Secretary of State's office for the Secretary of State then to designate a date of publication under his authority under Section 991 and 35.0953B. Sends that bill, or he notifies the Legislative Reference Bureau of his designated publication date. And at that point, the Legislative Reference Bureau takes the actions that are necessary to, publish it in the record. And thereafter, the Secretary of State then also has the duty of publishing the act in the official state newspaper. I should mention that has not been done by the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State has not done that. That is also a statutory requirement that the act be published in the official state newspaper. That's Section 14.3810C, which relate to the additional duties of the Secretary of State in the publication process. That has not been done as well. So the act has not only been not published under the authority of the Secretary of State, the act has not been published in the official state newspaper, which under the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel versus Wisconsin Department of Administration case, that's a 2009 WIS 79, paragraph 32, this court reiterated that general notice to the public of the laws by which all will be bound is the policy that drives publication. And there has been no publication in the official state.
The Secretary of State gets the bill. Does he call up the Legislative Reference Bureau and say, I've got 10 days, I'm picking day 7?
No, he notifies them by a writing. And I believe it's in the appellate record at appellate 1 and I think 2.
And does that notification have to correspond to the publication date that you're talking about?
Then at that time, he designates a publication date. In this case, he rescinded it, but he initially designated that. I believe it's in the appellate record at 1 and 2, and his rescission is at 104.
there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sage. Court will take a very brief recess. Very brief. Gives you time to collect your thoughts and gives the court time to collect its thoughts. 5 minutes.